following is an interview with Michael Roberts, Internet Reputation Management and Litigation Specialist for Rexfield.com, a company that helps businesses and individuals protect themselves from online attacks of libel, defamation, privacy, and more. The interview was conducted on August 24, 2010, by show host Grant Crowell of RealSEO.com.
Michael, thanks for joining us here over at RealSEO. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
I followed your official title at Rexfield, that's R-E-X-X-F-I-E-L-D.com, as a digital forensic analyst, as a victim's advocate, but I'm particularly interested in what's been dubbed your unofficial title of anonymous blogger bounty hunter. How do you get coined with that term?
I can't remember the origins. It was a young British guy or somebody that was having a lot of problems and just tagged with a Skype message at some point.
Explain your title. What do you do for people?
It's being constantly redefined because I invented the job, I guess. I became a victim of internet libel myself and had a business destroyed and was vocationally, emotionally, and financially paralyzed. When I was trying to work out what to do with my life, I realized that maybe I wasn't alone. So I reached out on a blog or a message board, a forum somewhere, asking if there were people that were having problems. And within 24 hours, I think it was, I received an email from a $500 million company that was struggling with this. And they hired me to help them unmask their antagonists and haven't looked back.
You've certainly been moving forward with now being a bit of a celebrity on a CBS Early Show and being the subject of some national media attention as well. And this seems to revolve a lot around what has been brought to the public's attention by your client, Carla Franklin, who wanted to unmask the identity of her taunters, of cyberbullies, people that were doing name-calling and arguably defamation, defamatory comments on YouTube. A lot of other people have put it to the wayside. Some have been trying to take matters in their own hands. You were somebody that really helped her unearth this kind of information. Can you give a little bit of information to our audience without going into specifics about the work you've been doing for Carla Franklin?
I'm not sure if celebrity is appropriate if I only had 2.5 seconds of dialogue, but I was there with Carla and naturally can't speak about the case too much at the moment because it is in process. But what I can tell you is reiterate what Carla made very clear, that the issue is not about cyberbullying per se. It's bigger than that. It's about harassment. It's about empowering women who are being victimized, that there are answers for them. She's a fighter and she has a very noble character. That's one thing that jumped out at me right away. She showed great restraint before acting with this action rather than impulsively jumping on the litigation bandwagon. I can't speak too much more than that at the moment, but it'll come out if you watch the case as we move along.
We're doing this recording on Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. I understand there's going to be a ruling by the Manhattan District Court on September 2nd. Could you explain to our audience the possible outcomes, whether it rules in your favor or against your favor, and what's the next step?
I believe it's a hearing on that date. I'm not sure how quickly the court moves. I have no way of predicting. All I can do is look at other cases, for example, and give some examples. Lascua Cohen's case, similar case last year, which had as much, probably more media attention, and they prevailed in obtaining the information they needed. That was an interesting case. I helped on the sidelines on that one. For example, the information that was provided by Google included the email address, which was readily traceable to Rosemary Port, who was the antagonist in that case. That was a sloppy on her part in that had she used a disposable email address, that case would have been potentially finished a lot differently because it was an email address she had used for other purposes. Beyond that, it was almost 1 year to the day from the original posting date to when the information was delivered or revealed by Google. In most cases, and this everybody should take note, doesn't matter what the statute of limitations is in a state, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, even in some states, the internet service providers such as Cox Cable or Roadrunner, whoever it is that the antagonist connects to the internet through, usually delete their IP address log files within 6 months. That's the smoking gun that you need that inexorably points, if you will, to the actual author, or at least their household or office, not necessarily the individual, but circumstantial evidence would put the rest together from there.
Even for people who are aware of a statute of limitations of 1 year, it's another question is how long does the information stay on the servers of the content publisher, ISP, whatever it is, of the problem comments for log files, whatever, in this case, problem comments around video. That's the situation with Carla Franklin. It apparently is defamatory comments made in a video on YouTube. Even though that has been removed, damage has been done, and looking as a way of gathering evidence, as Carlos mentioned, is connecting the dots and who might be doing this. I presume you've done a lot of work or had to work with Google on making similar requests. I don't know if you've dealt with this with YouTube before, but what is your take on how Google handles internet libel?
I think they could do a better job. I prefer dealing with Yahoo and Microsoft. They're very good corporate citizens with accountability and issues of providing the evidence that's required. You need to remember there's two stages to this. The first wave of subpoenas goes to the forward-facing website, in this case, YouTube. And inside their proprietary or their locked-up log files is the information that we're seeking, which is an IP address and hopefully other things, email addresses and so forth. But the IP address is the one thing that most antagonists aren't sophisticated enough to fake or spoof or use proxies. That doesn't tell us, of course, who it is. We don't know even what ISP it is. So it's very important that they deliver it quickly. Like I said, Yahoo, Microsoft, GoDaddy, lots of the big ISPs are very quick. Google, up until recently, or even still now, would usually insist that we file a suit in Santa Clara County, California. And you're looking at between an attorney there and court fees, maybe $5,000 just to get out of the starting block, just in order to serve a subpoena on Google. And then they would risk it. Generally, I found that they resist that anyway. Not always. We started getting into the habit of filing a case in Santa Clara and then trying to get ex parte application and orders. That's where rather than a subpoena, we actually go before the judge ex parte without Google present or the unknown Doe, of course, at the John or Jane Doe, and persuading the court to issue an order on the spot because our evidence is so compelling as to why we need it. And that way, we didn't have to worry about Google's objections. Whereas if we issue subpoenas to the other ISPs, generally speaking, they would give notification to the target or the unknown defendant, give them 30 days or 14 days to respond. And if they don't, they would just give us the information. It's wonderful. It's a walk in the park. Thankfully, now there's a new rule in California that came into effect in January this year, where we can very easily domesticize a foreign from the other 49 states subpoenas to make them enforceable in California for maybe $100. That's now making things a lot easier. A lot of people don't know about that, so take note. You don't need to file in California court anymore. And remember, I'm not an attorney, so make sure you check this stuff out with your attorney.
That is true. You're an anonymous blogger bounty hunter, but you're not anonymous.
All care, no responsibility.
You do have some beef with Google over how they display search results. And I've read what's on your site at rexfield.com. That's two X's. And you have an interesting article there. You have your own hypothesis about how Google displays search results, and sometimes they include hastily written, false, maliciously posted pages where that should be reserved for things that might be more relevant, more accurate. You title this, your hypothesis, the Google Humility Algorithm. Can you explain that a bit more for our audience?
Being humble is a wonderful thing if we do it voluntarily. Being humiliated by others is a wonderful thing if we learn the lessons from it. But when it's not true, I don't think it's such a good thing. And I must say, a lot of our research, other people's work have been a catalyst for the things that we've done, the experiments we've run. There seems to be this phenomenon that doesn't matter what SEO tricks you use, and I'm not an SEO, but I understand the limitations and capabilities. Doesn't matter what you do with a client that's having problems with reputation, position 3 or 4 on the first page of Google seems to be especially reserved for something negative, whether it be Mother Teresa or anybody else, where the SEO guys or reputation specialists in SEO would try to dilute the negative postings. There would always be one that the worst of the bunch would be welded into place, number 3 or number 4, whereas everything else is moving all around it with the SEO efforts. Some people call this a diversity algorithm. It's commonly called the diversity algorithm. I call it the humility algorithm because that's what it does to my clients. Yeah, I'm sure it's in there. Google is pretty much silent on it, to my knowledge, at least the last time I checked. I think it's wrong. If something is there, you know, it should be on page 20. I mean, let's face it, a lot of the garbage that we see on page 1 of Google is the 70s equivalent of graffiti on a toilet wall at the school in the cubicle. For a good time, call Mary and a phone number. There's no distinction on page 1 of Google as to what belongs in the toilet and what belongs in the grand ballroom. Now, let's face it, in a house, the toilets are well marked because you don't want to go into a toilet when you're hoping to eat food. And I think there should be some remedies opportunities for this, whether it be some type of crowdsourced voting on trash. Just get rid of it. There's just so much there. I think we need a search engine for grown-ups. Most of what I see with my clients is still teenage high school playground stuff.
Now, I want to make sure our audience understands what you're saying here. Is you believe, based on what you've seen from a lot of the clients you've had and a lot of the analysis you've done on Google search results, that Google may be purposely putting in something negative, as it can be denoted, to keep us humble. The funny thing is, I myself have this situation, Google Grant Kroll, and I have one of those things. I think, how the heck did that get in there with all the other stuff that I have about me and some things that have some great, really great link popularity, and this thing that doesn't seem to show up anywhere near, whether it's Google Page Rank or link popularity or whatever, or just by the fact that it's so new, and voila, it happens. So it does seem like there could be some truth to that if it's not definitive, but what does Google have to gain from doing something like this? And could online video be something potentially damaging considering how well YouTube videos show up? Couldn't somebody just be doing a real negative video, put it on YouTube, and then that be placed on the first page of search results, sometimes even with a thumbnail? Isn't that kind of dangerous?
Video is your forte. We need to employ the methods that you preach. I don't know if the 3 or 4 position, I'm looking at yours now, for example, and position 4 actually has videos, but they don't look too bad.
We're pretty good at real SEO getting to show up what we want right away. They got some really good popularity for the vast majority of people, you know, especially when it comes to their own personal / professional reputation. I think it's interesting because it's harder and harder to separate the two when you're online. You can't say this is just for my personal stuff like you can on Facebook, and this is just for my professional stuff. Let's have a separate search engine. It all intermixes.
Of course it does. Yeah. And the weakest link is what the people that matter, like employers or girlfriends' parents, are going to take notice of. And even if it's not credible in context or the writing style is that of a 7-year-old, often people are going to err on the side of caution rather than get mixed up in what, as incredible as it may seem, what could be somebody that has some skeletons in their closet. Google has a very long memory, and you need to make sure that it forgets it, what puts it out of the Google mind, if you will, and get it off page 1 through 3. But back to your question about the videos, the humility algorithm, of course, if you spend $10,000 on a fantastic video or screencast or something that you get up on number 1 on Google, and then 3 places down, it says that Acme Corporation is run by a bunch of tax cheats, it's not going to be good for the investment in the video production.
I'm fortunate enough to be working with a company like Real SEO, where I get my YouTube videos and Real SEO videos up under my own name. Most people don't have that luxury or don't have that good fortune. Most people do suffer the way you've said. It brings me to a law that has been used by content publishers, the Communications Decency Act. This has been often cited by YouTube. They have their own policy for takedown of what's obscene or whatnot. But if there's an issue like this, look how long you guys have had to go through this with them. They haven't exactly been cooperative. And they cite, well, there's a Communications Decency Act. We don't have to do anything. We're not liable.
Well, that's not the way they word it, actually. If I sent a letter to the editor and said that Grant Kroll is a tax cheat, for example, or that you beat somebody up on July 18th, 2010. You went to the newspaper, showed them your passport, you were in a different country on that day, for example. They're in big trouble. They will not only be liable for libel, they're expected to print a retraction, and yet you could still sue them. If I publish on YouTube or Blogspot or Picus or anywhere like that, the same thing, then you go to Google and show them your passport or email them with a copy of your passport to prove that it's not true. You'll probably get a response along the effect of, Google does not make any attempts to determine the truth or falsity of things published on our websites. We are subject to Section 230C of the Communications Decency Act, and for that reason, we do not remove information, blah, blah, blah. If you get a court order, though, we'll be happy to comply. That, to me, is a cop-out, because the actual section that they're quoting, Section 230C, comes under the heading of Good Samaritan Shielding for Third-Party Republishers, I think it is a quote, words to that effect. And the actual term Good Samaritan is emphasized by Congress. It's in quotes and bold in the law. In other words, the intent here is that if Google were to see somebody bleeding and dying in the ditch because they're being digitally beat up, they can remove that material, and whoever the author is can't sue them for interfering with free speech, for example, true, false, or otherwise. That's option A. Option B is they can also choose to leave it there. And Google, time and time again, and I'm not going to say all-inclusively always, but I can say every time I have experienced it, have turned a blind eye, which is exact opposite to the intent that is obvious by the emphasis added to the Good Samaritan. And we all know who that is. That's the guy that stopped to help the guy on the side of the road, even though he's a foreigner, while all the priests and teachers of the law and everything else walked past. That's what I think Google should be, a good corporate citizen, and look at the intent. But what makes me a little bit more upset is the way the emails that are sent out are worded. It almost looks like they're not allowed to remove it because of this law, rather than this law gives us the choice to remove it or leave it there, and at this time we're going to leave it there. I've showed many objective people to read it in context. No, they're not allowed to. That law makes it illegal for them to remove it. So that's a problem. It's a 1996 law enacted by Congress, which gives shielding because of, as the internet was beginning to grow, how can those providers look at everything that's published by third parties if we're going to have a free and open internet? So I agree, there needs to be protection for them, but it needs to be reasonable. And I would like to see a mechanism in place where people don't need to spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 in court to sue somebody for calling them a tax cheat, for example. There should be some type of reasonable alternative dispute resolution process that Google would honor, or Yahoo or Microsoft. It's not such a big problem because I don't see Yahoo and Bing having diversity algorithms or humility algorithms. So what Congress has effectively done, in my view, is subsidized internet libel. The beneficiaries that can take advantage of it, and that's every website, particularly those that have pay-per-click ads, for example, because even negative pages are potential advertising platforms for Google AdWords or any other. I'm not singling out Google. It's just that they're the ones that we've had the most problems with, and they're the ones that wave around a flag saying, do no evil. It was obsolete, I think, as soon as the law was actually released.
That seems to be what you're saying, is the Communications Decency Act has created an incentive for libel to proliferate. YouTube is one of those places, as Carla Franklin has been subjected to, because one is, you know, the business factor, more subscribers, but two, it seems to be a legal concern with how much you can remove from there, and thus Braid getting some unfriendly publicity. I mean, what we hear oftentimes is what the media covers is for stuff being removed and saying, no, this is against free speech, or the little kid that's playing music in the background of Prince, and they go after, and then that creates bad PR for everybody. And then Google and YouTube are looked at as doing censorship. But what you're saying is this seems to take away from the issues of people really getting hurt. People like Carla Franklin, who all you're asking for is Google show some concern, be a good Samaritan, and assess if this is actually true or not. And rather than saying, well, we're not going to do anything until we get a court order. Then what do you propose as the mechanism? Is this going to take, now, if Congress is subsidizing libel, like you say, with the Communications Decency Act, what would subsidize funds for people to go in and assess the truth? Is this something given to Google? And then how do you assess who gets it and who doesn't? Does this raise just another issue of how are you going to start policing the internet based on the standard of truth?
Rather than say it's an incentive for libel, because the incentive to libel just comes from people that have no conscience, the closest distance between where they are and point B is a straight line, regardless of who's standing in front of them, whether that motivation be greed, money, job prospects, or just antisocial. So it's not so much it's an incentive. The incentive comes from their seared conscience, if you will, but it removes the deterrent. This libel subsidy removes the deterrent for those people for doing that. Don't get me wrong, I am all for anonymous free speech. I have seen many, many sexual predators. Well, I haven't seen it. I know and can reasonably assume that many sexual predators or white-collar criminals or whatever it might be have run out of town, communities or near schools, whatever it might be. Let's let them have it if it's deserved. Free speech is not free. There's always a cost to it. If that cost comes at the expense of a repeat offender or somebody that deserves to be exposed, then it's acceptable to me. It's when the cost of the free speech is borne on the shoulders of the innocent and those with clean hands that I'm outraged. These allegations that are the equivalent in intellect of bathroom wall graffiti actually do make a difference now. An employer, for example, looking for Fred Smith, the first place headhunters go in their due diligence process is Google. So you need to look after it. So there is a real cost to that. And even if they do not believe it, they still consider their customers or the other people in the office. So if they have two equally viable and qualified candidates for a job, and one of them has nothing on Google because their name's John Smith and there's 5 million of them and you don't know which is which, and the other person has a much rarer or unique name, and position three is accusing them of wife beating or whatever it might be, who are they going to choose? Even if it is very sloppily written. It's real. And that's a good point, by the way. People that have unique names, it's much more important for them. Make sure you take control of Google's results before Google does.
That's what people working with someone like you and your team can be doing. What should be changed about the Communications Decency Act? Or should there be some other kind of legislation? Okay. Should there be an incentive?
I'd like to see it changed. And this is probably a good time to mention there's a charity that we're going to be incorporating soon. It's not incorporated yet, so it's not a charity yet, but that's the plan. But the website has been established. It's Free Speech V3, Free Speech V as in version, thenumeral3.org. You'll also get there, fsv3.org. We've actually drafted a bill to actually make some adjustments to 230C or the CDA. We're not publishing it yet. It's still a work in progress, but we've got quite a few activist attorneys and judge candidates as well in the coming elections that are working on that. And we also have a couple of congressmen and senators that are interested in participating. I can't give too many more details than that at the moment, but if you have a look at the website, you can see we're just looking for common sense. And an answer might be a type of binding arbitration that ISPs can voluntarily comply with. And this will be certified and qualified arbitrators, whether they be retired judges, or we're hoping that we'll be able to get a lot of work from home moms, for example, and dads that are attorneys that have done the arbitration and mediation courses. We want to do this globally. The site that we're building for this is multilingual, very expandable. I can understand Google's hesitance to remove something from the internet because, as you say, they get accused of chilling free speech on one hand, or letting somebody die a slow vocational death on the other hand. It's, so they're in a tough spot. I have to have mercy on that basis. Should they make us go to court for it? And we're looking for volunteers and experts in First Amendment for America and the equivalent in all the other countries to come on board and help us with direction as to where we can go. In most American states, I think all American states, the statute of limitations for libel begins the day of publication. My question is, what defines publication? Is that when the author pressed submit on their little smear campaign? Is it when the first person actually visits the site? Is it when Google indexes it for the first time? Or is it when it's visited the first time? In the United Kingdom, it is every single time a person clicks that link and opens that web page, the statute of limitations begins again. So essentially a perpetual statute of limitations. I don't think that's been changed, although there are moves towards it. In my homeland of Australia, it's similar but different. So I'd like to see people come together and discuss the tolling statutes and so forth, and maybe taking the emphasis of Good Samaritan in CDA literally.
A little bit of a push. At least it would give some ideas for self-policing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Industry regulation, I think, is the way to go. The federal government should be building roads and keeping a militia. They can keep their nose out of the internet. They'll mess it up like everything else. Let's get the reasonable majority of internet service provider citizens to get together and reason together and come up with something that, well, it literally saves lives. I personally talked 3 people out of suicide on the phone because of relentless internet defamation. And unfortunately, a child of a client succumbed to the pressure just maybe 2 months ago.
Wow.
That's very sad.
That's very unfortunate. It would seem in the industry that at Real SEO that we're in is online video, on what an incredible impact video can have, you know, by the nature of you're including more senses, sight,
exactly,
sound, and on how viral it goes. So if you're talking about the negative impact of what something like that can have, that can be huge. And I would say it could arguably a lot huger than simply text. Even if you're seeing a text headline that's very unfavorable, if you're seeing that little video graphic or saying, watch this video here, people are naturally going to be even more curious about it. The unfortunate thing is if people are becoming very emotionally distraught to such an extreme level that it can even be despairing beyond hope, that's a scary thing. So Michael, tell us about the term libel tourism.
That's essentially reduce it down to the basic elements where, or the person that has been injured by the defamation doesn't necessarily take the most obvious jurisdiction to file the court case where they live, for example, or if it's a company where their headquarters is. They look at all the different jurisdictions in which they've been damaged or could argue that they've been damaged and pick the one that is most expedient or has the longest statute of limitations or has different statutes for damages, where damages might be 2 times the actual damages for punitive damage, whatever the case may be. There's a few very good examples. There was an Australian High Court, which is the highest court in Australia, my homeland, that actually I think was a wonderful finding, very articulate. I was pretty proud of it, actually. The case was Dow Jones versus Gutnick. Now, this was an appeal. That's why Dow Jones is named as the plaintiff here or at the beginning. But Gutnick sued Dow Jones because a website that was published in the United States was readable in Australia, damaged his reputation. It was false. And the court's finding that if people wish to do business in or indeed travel to or live in or utilize the infrastructure of different countries, they can hardly expect to be absolved from compliance with the laws of those countries. The fact that publication might occur everywhere does not mean that it occurs nowhere. They went on further to say the specter which Dow Jones sought to conjure up in the present appeal of a publisher forced to consider every article it publishes on the World Wide Web against the defamation laws of every country from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe is seen to be unreal when it is recalled that in all except the most unusual of cases, identifying the person about whom material is to be published will readily identify the defamation law to which that person may resort. And Mr. Gutnick in this case lived in Australia. He chose the right jurisdiction. He was damaged there. That's where the damage was found. In Nebraska, you are permitted to file in the county in which the offense occurred or in the county where the damage was sustained. You have a choice there. And that, of course, can cross state borders as well, depending on which is most expedient to the plaintiff. So that's it in a nutshell. The United Kingdom is a good place, and they're trying to change the laws at the moment. And when I say good, I'm coming from the position that my clients are genuine victims. And so our team can, or the attorneys that work with us can advise on that. Ireland is a particularly good place. The good name of a person is taken very seriously there. It's a cheap place to litigate. The judges don't take any garbage when it comes to hurting somebody's reputation.
This is a very interesting point, because if your comments are directed at somebody, wherever they're based and wherever that information can be received, it's important for people to understand the area of video, that things can have a point of effect. Libel tourism in the States, in the U.S., how a lot of states have different laws for defamation. Some don't even have criminal penalties, only civil in regards to publication. But it's good for to understand is it isn't that it's no man's land. It can be argued over where the offended party is located, where the harm or where the damage was done. And I guess in the case of video, could it be argued that because video can be watched anywhere with internet connection worldwide, where things aren't being blocked by the government, that the offended party can be experiencing the damage wherever they happen to be living, and thus argue to have the laws for defamation based on where they reside rather than where the person is doing it, thinking that if the person doing it has an easier time because libel laws or defamation laws aren't so strong, but maybe they're not thinking about, hey, that's not all there is.
Yeah, in a nutshell, it's not so much whether it's video or text, it's the conduit that delivers that. And the conduit here is the internet. The format isn't so much a problem. In both instances, whether it be text or video, they are an enduring form of media. They stay and can be watched again and again. So that is libel. Beyond choosing a specific venue, there's also issues where multiple people have been injured. So if there are, for example, 5 or 6 plaintiffs or victims of libel in multiple states, you have the diversity issue, and then they can get between them and work out which is the best venue. And then the one that lives in the best venue files, and the others can come on board. And often that'll get kicked up. You know, sometimes it goes to federal court as well. The defendant might move it up. You mentioned criminal. 17 states in the U.S. do have criminal statutes for defamation and libel. It's not too often that they're used. There was a big one in Colorado recently. I think he got like 24 years, but it was incredibly egregious and just a horrible case. But most countries in Europe, it's criminal. I live in Finland half the year. Somebody came after me, one of the suspects in a case we were working on, and I was libeled. They claimed that they were coming to see me in Finland. There's nothing wrong with saying that. They're kind of going to come and see me, but because of the libel that had been published, I was able to have charges filed, and they still filed. And if that person sets foot in Finland, they can be arrested criminally.
On one level, it's amazing how sweeping it can be internationally. On another, it can seem rather daunting and intimidating. You feel like you're in no man's land with what you might post as an anonymous comment on YouTube, but wherever that's in, you could be subject to the laws in another country, and rightfully so. It always raises other issues of what if you're in a country that has a horrible record of human rights? I mean, here we're talking about European countries in the U.S., and there's always that side. Will the government recognize the jurisdiction of another country, too? And it gets complex, and it gets intimidating. It just seems to make more of the argument of work with some professionals here if your personal reputation is really at stake and can be damaging. With all the work that you've done on internet libel and all the work you've done for your clients, have you seen anything in regards to online video that's a bit of a trend when people are posting anything defamatory, taunting, intimidating? Heavy metal music.
Really, like music that just makes you want to kill somebody. The people with small minds that libel people using videos, for some reason, they're really into heavy and just really aggressive music. So there's something there. There's a correlation there. That's for somebody else. That's psychology, psychiatry or something.
There's a difference between doing a video as opposed to posting a comment around a video and how people can do that. And you can do a defamatory anonymous video. You don't have to be showing yourself, you know, like saying you're doing a mashup of somebody. Say if it happened to be on Carl Franklin, you know, a mashup of that stuff with graphics that were making these same statements. That could have more of the potential for going viral too. It's entirely possible that if somebody was just hell-bent That could happen to any of us at any time.
I'm sorry, but it will.
Well, you got to have a thick skin at the same time. Don't not do anything about it.
And one thing to remember is what I tell my clients that are particularly distraught is the truth. Well, my daddy used to say this, but the truth will remain the truth. Doesn't matter how it's believed, perceived, or projected. And the other thing, of course, is when you are the target of defamation, you're actually a different species to everybody else on the planet because it's about you and it's your emotions that are involved. And most other people, the emotions don't come into it and they might read it once. You know what? They probably forgot about it in the morning. It's often not that big a deal. So take what you're feeling, and there's nothing wrong with your feelings. Feelings are right, but feelings do not always accurately reflect reality. So I'm not trying to undermine the feelings, but what I'm saying is don't take it quite so hard. Cut it in half. If it's still bad, then do something about it.
The Carla Franklin case does have a good involvement with YouTube. YouTube is the sexy headline that has gotten a lot of media attention. And because YouTube is the number one video channel, it's actually the number two search engine behind its own parent company, Google. Have you given thought to what YouTube could be doing differently in how it handles internet libel situations? Say if you were the YouTube head for a day, what would you change?
Don't get me wrong. I don't want you to think I'm a Google basher. I think it's an incredible company. It's too big. It's like this grown-up body, but with teenage mentality as far as the quality of the results. I don't think they are rearranging, whether it be YouTube or Google, rearranging the information in the way that they could be in accordance with their mission.
What you would recommend for people who find themselves in a situation similar to Carla Franklin's?
Did you say if or when?
Probably more likely on the when, because it's happened to me. You don't even have to be doing video. It still happens to you.
Okay.
I mean, in Carla's case, she didn't make her own video. She was featuring a video, but you don't even need to have a video done about you. Anybody can do a video about you. It doesn't even matter if you're trying to participate in the space or not. You're giving up control of your reputation. So let's just say, for most people, when? What is your tip for them and how to take proper action or go about it the right way?
The video practitioners that are listening to your shows would be one of the first places I'd go, because videos do rank so high. And as you said, it's not text. It brings the humanity back into the situation. And we all know about it. We've sent an email to somebody perfectly innocently asking or instructing or whatever we do. And for some reason, the context and the tonal inflections that are missing in text just cause it to mean something else. And in relationships, I'm sure, have been destroyed just because of email and not thinking it through. But if we get a real face in there, and I'm not saying you have to get up there and cry crocodile tears, but a video, I think, would be a great way to mitigate the damage that's being done. And the charity, the FSV3 charity that we're setting up, we're hoping to actually have volunteers for video responses to critics. We don't do spin. When I say that, we don't do spin. If somebody messes up, makes a poor life choice and suffers the consequences, we're not interested in spinning that. If you want to do that, go and find a PR person or a publicist. If you're not trying to hide something, we'll certainly give you a voice to, you know, address what the fallout from that bad choice. But don't try to cover it up, not with us. But the innocent victims, absolutely. We would encourage your people who are interested in this to come alongside some of the pro bono work that we do to help people out. And look for business. I'm not talking just pro bono. There are big, big companies out there that haven't got a clue what to do, and high net worth individuals. I had one client that spent over $600,000 in 1 year trying to chase the reputation management tail and getting nowhere. There's a lot of business out there in reputation management for the video folk.
That would certainly be the case from what we've seen. If a client who is suffering an online reputation issue that's negative to them, that right. If they're willing to be doing video, giving themselves good, positive content that people want, seems to make a lot of good sense. So if they're open to producing content, that's great. I've had some well-known clients that didn't want to do anything. And of course, they got negative publicity from their professional activities and they wanted to appear at the top, but they didn't want to participate. They just assumed, well, I should be appearing at the top because it's my name. That was the mentality. Do you ever find yourself that you have to be in a situation where you have to talk to them about the importance of them either actually participating or just letting you do your job without your hands being tied?
You know, often, unfortunately, some of our clients have been so broken that they're almost powerless. We find ourselves going way outside our pay grade and effectively counselors a lot of the time. Yeah, I have seen signs and little episode of what you're describing. Egos can always be a problem. The worst combination, of course, is ignorance and arrogance. And that's a pretty deadly combination. And then when you add intelligence to the mix, it's even worse. As far as mitigating the problems, don't wait for it to happen. It will. Google's not going away. Google wants to control everything, including your name. Dilute now. Dilute the problems before they happen and do it in a way as if it already has happened. So when it does happen, you'll have warning. The negative stuff might appear on page 5 or 6. You'll catch it with your Google alerts rather than just popping up on page 1. Make sure that you send a cease and desist letter. Often it just inflames the situation. But if you do have to resort to the unfortunate remedy of legal action and litigation, it shows that the jury or the judge that you did in good faith make an attempt to correct the errors that were either deliberately through omission or commission posted about you. Make sure you preserve the evidence. We spoke about the perishable nature of the digital artifacts and evidence with the log files. Social engineering, by the way. You need a lot of social engineering because the 20th century legal techniques, although you need to observe them in the discovery process and the litigation process, it's too slow. So you need to get in there actively, find somebody that can help you follow the electronic footprints, triangulate. Essentially, you need to triangulate as many times as you can reasonably do the originating IP addresses or the individuals that are responsible. And that, of course, won't always be the same place. It could be work, it could be McDonald's, it could be their home from a hotspot, whatever.
A lot of great tips. And I want to leave our audience with, I think you might have a scoop for us. Is that right?
I can tell you what happens behind the scenes at CBS Early Show.
What happened behind the scenes of that show? I'm first interested in how they contact you and what was going on right up until the point where you started shooting.
Well, it looks quite organized on TV, but it's a madhouse. I can tell you that the cast of the show is much prettier than the crew. They were short on microphones, so they were having problems getting me set up with a microphone. So I volunteered. I got my iPhone out with my plug-in microphone. I said, listen, I can just dial in, bring my signal in. So I was almost the first call-in live guest. Some people may have seen in the media Tom Corbett versus Twitter. Tom Corbett, I think he's the Attorney General for the great state of Pennsylvania. There was a Twitterer by the name of BF Barbie and also Casablanca PA were the two Twitterers. Wanted Twitter to reveal the identities and IP addresses and everything else for these people, and they were denied this. Now, I have no idea how much was spent of taxpayers' money, but I noticed on the different tweets that numbers of $100,000 and 5 attorneys working on this case were floating around. I don't know if that's true. We were kind of curious about this because we thought that maybe they were going about it the wrong way from the PR perspective, but from a technical or of an investigative perspective. And we found BF Barbie in 16 minutes, but they didn't want it. We offered it. By then, it had blown up so much that they weren't interested. The offer was probably impulsive on our part. We probably should have looked a bit closer to see whether this was a spin or a genuine case of defamation. I still don't know.
I know it's a prized American right to criticize government officials and do so anonymously. And I think it just shows a spectrum of, well, there really is an educated need on both ends, from people who are just callously posting comments that are degenerate name calling or taunting, and those who are criticizing elected officials. And it is a range of understanding. And, you know, again, that's another area of video where a lot of comments happen. I myself have a YouTube channel of a lot of government officials and people posting all types of comments, things that would be very questionable language, to say the least. It is finding that balance. It's great to have people participate, but it is a double-edged sword. I think you deal with people who are on one side of that sword that causes a lot of damage and harm, basically protecting victims, real victims, people who really hurt, and not are just simply dealing with criticism in general and how they can recover damages and get on with their lives. So thank you for that. Where can people see more of the work you do and your services? I take it that's rexfield.com with a double X in there?
That's right. And of course, the nonprofit that we're in the process. Once again, freespeechv3.org. And I'd encourage anybody that is sensitive or sympathetic to the plight of these people we're describing. And I promise you, there are many, many. There's a lot of carnage being done. It's the one thing, if I could get through to people that have not experienced this firsthand, until you've experienced it firsthand or observed somebody that you love experiencing this firsthand, it's almost impossible to actually imagine how bad it is. This isn't like the front page of a newspaper that is fleeting, that's there for one day and then it goes away. It causes the subject of the defamation, in that case, you know, quite a bit of discomfort. But this is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's the equivalent of front page because it's specific to that person's name. It's not like in the classifieds or somewhere that's hard to find. It's in your face the whole time. Anybody that is sympathetic, please sign up with Free Speech or FSV3.org. Give us your ideas. What can we do? What would you like to see done if we can get the right team moving on this?
Whether anonymous or disclosing your full name, it's good information to have in a great forum.
It doesn't matter. We'll find them.
That'll be great. Hey, we'll find you anyway.
We do have an 85% success rate. You could beat us, no problems. I'm sure your listeners could beat us easy enough or make us work very, very hard.
You know a lot more about how the courts work. So there's a good synergy there and a good overlap. You're providing a much needed service to people and working with some good partners. So Michael Roberts of RexField.com. It has been an educational pleasure, and I thank you for educating our audience about real SEO, and this will encourage them to know more about internet libel and know about legal repercussions with online video and how to be responsible at the same time, preserving creativity and free speech. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to an interview with Michael Roberts, Internet Reputation Management and Litigation Specialist for RexField.com, a company that helps businesses and individuals protect themselves from online attacks of libel, defamation, privacy, and more. If you're in need of these services, contact Michael at 408-916-5977 or go to RexField.com. That's RexField. And fill out the website's contact form with your information. Thank you for listening and check out RexField.com for important news and tips on understanding internet libel and protecting your reputation.